fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the show. I'm very glad you've tuned in. You know, anyone with an earshot of me ever been to Sevilla, Spain? I was there with my family, oh, I guess it was probably 12 years ago. Wonderful and beautiful city, very, very old. It's funny, what I distinctly remember, perhaps not more than anything else, but I do remember, they had these lemon trees growing right in the middle of the city. You could walk down the street and there were lemon trees on there. Not often you could see that. And I just went over and thought, oh, I just took one down to eat it. And trust me, I don't know what kind of lemons they were, but they're a lot better to look at than to eat. Anyway, no need to say any more. But I want to talk a little bit about Sevilla or Seville, Spain, or however you pronounce it. But not the Sevilla, Spain that people see when they go there today. I want to talk about the Sevilla of about 500 years ago. The Sevilla of the infamous Spanish Inquisition, when the church used the power of the state to burn at the stake anyone suspected of not being a good and proper Catholic. I want you to, with me, to imagine this scene. Imagine it's in the midst of the Inquisition, with people being burned at the stake by the authority of the churchmen. Now, that's not that too hard to imagine because, well, it really happened. But now imagine in the midst of this, Jesus comes back to earth. He doesn't return in the great glory of which the New Testament talks about in regards to his second coming. Instead, Jesus comes back as the humble Galilean depicted in the Gospels. And he comes back this time to Sevilla, Spain, and does so right in the midst of the Inquisition. This imaginary scene is taken from Fyodor Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov, from a famous chapter called The Grand Inquisitor. Let me read you a little bit from Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor. My story is laid in Spain, in Seville, in the most terrible time of the Inquisition, when fires were lighted every day to the glory of God, and in this splendid auto da fe, the wicked heretics were burned. Oh, of course, this is not the coming in which he will appear, according to his promise, at the end of time in all this heavenly glory, in which he came down, in all his heavenly glory, in which will be as sudden as lightning flashing from east to west. No, he visited his children only for a moment, and there were the flames crackling round the heretics. In his infinite mercy, he came once more among men in that human shape, and which he walked among men for 33 years, 15 centuries ago. He came down to the hut pavements of the southern town in which on a day before almost 100 heretics had been burnt by the cardinal. The Grand Inquisitor in a magnificent auto da fe in the presence of the king, the court, the knights, the cardinals, the most charming ladies of the court, and the whole population of Seville. Auto da fe, Latin for acts of faith, though I believe the phrase originally meant the act of penance done by someone, the one deemed heretical by the church, before that person was punished, in popular vernacular, it came to mean the punishment itself. In this case, the act of faith was the actual burning of the heretics at the stake. One would, I guess, have to have faith or something like it to be so sure you were right and the other was wrong that you would burn alive the one had you deemed wrong. Anyway, the point is this in this story is Jesus comes back to earth, to Seville, Spain, while the church is in the process of torturing and then burning heretics. So in the story, what happens after Jesus appears to the people? Well, the crowd swoon around the Messiah, who moves silently in their midst with a gentle smile of infinite compassion. After he heals someone blind from birth, children throw flowers at his feet. When a funeral procession carries a young girl and sets her coffin before Jesus, his lips once more softly pronounce, "Maiden, arise." And she does just that. Then, what happens next? Amid all the drama and everything, after Christ heals the sick, what happens next? Just as he had healed 1,500 years earlier. Let me read you from Dostoevsky. There are cries, sobs, confusion among the people. At that moment, the cardinal himself, the grand inquisitor, passes by the cathedral. He is an old man, almost 90, tall and erect, with a withered face and sunken eyes, in which there is still a gleam of light. He is not dressed in his gorgeous cardinal's robes as he was the day before when he was burning the enemies of the Roman Church. At this moment, he is wearing his coarse old monk's cassock. At a distance behind him comes his gloomy assistants and slaves and the holy guard. He stops at the sight of the crowd and watches it from a distance. He sees everything. He sees them lay the coffin down at his feet, sees the child rise up, and his face darkens. He knits his thick gray brows and his eyes gleam with a sinister fire. He holds out his fingers and bids the guards to take him. And such is his power, so completely are the people cowed in submission and trembling obedience to him, that the crowd immediately makes way for the guards. And in the midst of a death-like silence, they lay hands on him and lead him away. The crowd instantly bows down to the earth like one man before the old inquisitor. He blesses the people in silence and passes on. And what does he have done? What does he do? He has the guard take Jesus away, and not a person in the crowd protests or says a word. They stand there, just as he wrote, in death-like silence. Such was the power of the Grand Inquisitor. Just like that, the masses move away and do nothing as the Grand Inquisitor arrests Jesus, who just healed this young girl, brought her back from death. The story then picks up later in a dungeon when that night the Grand Inquisitor comes to Jesus, who he imprisoned there. And he says to Jesus, this is what the Grand Inquisitor says to him. Why then art thou come to hinder us? For thou hast come to hinder us. Thou knowest that. But dost thou know what shall be tomorrow? But tomorrow I shall condemn thee and burn thee at the stake as the worst of heretics. And the very people today who have kissed thy feet, tomorrow, at the faintest sign from me, will rush up to heap upon you embers of thy fire. Knowest thou that? Whew. Imagine the audacity, the arrogance, the sense of personal power that this cardinal believes is found in his church office, that he says this to Jesus. Now, though Dostoevsky, at the time of this writing, was an ardent Russian nationalist, and he used the story to attack the Roman church, the story of the Grand Inquisitor really goes much deeper and can be read, I think, on many levels, and not just an attack on what he deemed to be the papal usurpation of religious and political power. And the one theme that I want to look at, the one that I think is the most prominent, deals with freedom, human freedom. Through millennia, philosophers, theologians, sciences, and psychologists, and others have all debated the whole question of free will. Are we truly free? Do we have free will? Are our choices determined for us? And if they are, and if we don't have free will, how can we be held culpable for anything that we do? Some argue that we have free will. Others argue that we don't, that our choices are determined for us by all that came before us. Others, called compatibilists, argue that though determinism is true, it doesn't contradict free will. Some argue that either way, whether our choices are free or not, it doesn't matter. Our fate is determined regardless of the choices we make. Others believe that everything is free, open, and undetermined. Others say that if God knows the future, our choices can't be free. Others argue, myself included, that God's foreknowledge does not determine our free choices. Some believing that God's foreknowledge of our choices, which means that we aren't free, they argue that God doesn't really know our free choices. The future, they say, is open, the unknown to God himself. Kind of a strange view, I think, in light of many Bible texts, but that's another story. Anyway, these questions go way back. You can read, for instance, in some literature coming out of ancient Greece, and you get the idea that they believe that regardless of our choices, free or not, our fate is sealed. You can choose whatever you want, but fate is fate, and nothing, not even the gods, can change that. That's what many of them believed. I mean, you ever read Oedipus Rex by Sophocles? In the play, this infant is born, and it's prophesied that as an adult, he's going to murder his father and marry his mother. That's the prophecy. Well, anyway, that's the prophecy, and the story, and everyone in the story knows about the prophecy, and they do everything they can to try and stop Oedipus from murdering his father and marrying his mother. They even take the infant Oedipus away to be killed. And after all, that certainly would stop it, wouldn't it? And what do you know? Before the play ends, guess what? Oedipus murders his father and marries his mother. That is, no matter what choices they made, in many cases, deliberate conscious choices, his fate was thus sealed. And thus his whole so-called freedom meant nothing. In Gustave Flaubert's Madame Bovary, Emma Bovary gets into an unhappy marriage and eventually falls into adultery, ultimately bringing ruin upon herself, her husband, and her child. In one pathetic scene of in the novel, her husband meets one of his wife's ex-lovers. She had already committed suicide. And Monsieur Bovary's talking to him about the affair and then ultimately the death of his wife and so on and so forth. And he pretty much exonerates this man from the affair, even though this guy was a cad who years earlier, sensing Emma Bovary's unhappiness, basically seduced her, promised her that he would run off together with her, and then the last minute drops her off. Her husband didn't know any of that. But anyway, not really knowing any of that, but just that they had an affair. Anyway, after talking to this man, Monsieur Bovary says to him basically, well, fate is to blame. Not the man, not his wife, not their adultery. No, fate and fate alone. How ludicrous. Even her ex-lover thought Mr. Bovary was pathetic. Now, though, in The Grand Inquisitor by Dostoevsky, we see a different kind of spin on freedom and free will. The Grand Inquisitor is, it seems, a free will theist. He believes that human beings have free will, have free choice, regardless of God's foreknowledge. In that sense, I guess I'm in the same camp as the Grand Inquisitor. And yet for him, the Grand Inquisitor, this freedom is precisely the problem with humanity. They have this gift of free will, but according to him, they don't know what to do with it. In fact, they are scared of it, and they really don't want it. Instead, he says they want someone like him, the Grand Inquisitor, to tell them what to do, to make their choices for them, just as long as those choices can help render them safe, secure, and well-fed. In a sense, the Grand Inquisitor reminds me of the British philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who argued that people will gladly give up all their rights and freedoms to any sovereign who can protect their lives and property. Here the old man makes pretty much the same point. Thus, in the story, the Grand Inquisitor starts to lecture Christ on his mistake of giving human beings freedom, using the biblical narrative of the temptation in the wilderness as his focal point. The old man, which is just another name for the Grand Inquisitor, tells Christ that he misunderstood human nature and that by granting humans freedoms, he increased their misery. And thus only by vanquishing freedom can humans be happy. He says, it's not freedom people want. No, he says, they want the bread that Christ refused to make when tempted by Satan to turn the rocks into bread. The Grand Inquisitor then kind of puts himself in the mind of Satan. And when Satan tempted Jesus to make the stones into bread, the Grand Inquisitor says that this is what the devil was really saying to Jesus. He says, quote, thou would goest into the world and are going with empty hands, with some promise of freedom which men in their simplicity and their natural unruliness cannot even understand, which they fear and dread, for nothing has ever been more insupportable for a man in a human society than freedom. But seest thou these stones in the parched wilderness? Turn them into bread, and mankind will run after thee like a flock of sheep, grateful and obedient. Whew. This is what the Grand Inquisitor says the devil was really telling Jesus. Forget this human free will stuff and all that jazz. They don't want it. They can't handle it. They are afraid of it. Now, however cynical, however nasty and hateful the old man is, he has a point. I mean, look at the world. Look at what human freedom has done to the world. Look at the free choices people make. And look at the havoc those choices often wreak. That's why I think existentialist philosopher John Paul Sartre wrote, quote, man is condemned to be free. What does that mean? He's condemned because he and she have to make their own choices, for which they and they alone are ultimately responsible. And look at how often they royally mess themselves up with those choices. Thus, in this sense, the Grand Inquisitor has a point, doesn't he? After all, had God not made humans free, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in, would we? Hence, the Grand Inquisitor continues, chiding Christ for not turning the stones into bread. Listen to what he says. This is brilliant. But thou would not deprive man of freedom and did reject the offer, thinking what freedom is worth if obedience is bought with bread? Thou did reply that man does not live by bread alone. does not know the ages will pass and humanity will proclaim by the lips of their sages that there is no crime and therefore no sin. There is only hunger. In the end, they will lay their freedom at our feet and say to us, make us your slaves, but feed us. They will understand themselves at last that freedom and bread enough for them are all inconceivable together, for never, never will they be able to share between them. They will be convinced, too, that they can never be free. They will be convinced, too, that they can never be free, for they are weak and vicious, worthless and rebellious. Thou did promise them the bread of heaven, but I repeat again, can it compare with earthly bread in the eyes of the weak, ever sinful and ignoble race of man? Woo! What's so powerful here, I think, is that there is some truth to what the Grand Inquisitor is saying. When people are hungry, when their children are hungry, look at how quickly the grand metaphysical questions of good and evil, right and wrong, are suddenly pushed into the background. He later tells Christ, in bread there was offered thee an invincible banner. Give bread and man will worship thee, for nothing is more certain than bread. Not even, he would go on to say, good and evil, right and wrong. Bread is more certain even than those things. The old man goes on with the same thing, railing against the freedom that Christ has given humanity. He said, instead of taking man's freedom from them, thou didst make it greater than ever. Did thou forget that man prefers peace and even death to the freedom of choice and the knowledge of good and evil? Nothing is more seductive for a man than his freedom of conscience, but nothing is a greater cause of suffering. Whew. Again, what I think is so astonishing is that for all his mendacity, for all his cynicism, and for all his evil, the Grand Inquisitor has a point. Human freedom has come at a terrible cost. Look around the world again. Look at the pain and the suffering and the outright evil that has come from the choices, free choices, that people make. In a sense, the Grand Inquisitor was saying to Jesus, who is God, you should have never made them free, because look at what they have done with this freedom. It has made them wretched. Give them bread and they will throw their freedom at your feet. Okay. But here's the thing. However right the Grand Inquisitor might have been, however much he might have a point, he missed the big point, the big picture. He chided Christ for giving human freedom, But you know, I don't think God had a choice. If God wanted beings who could love him, then God had no choice. He had to make them free, because only if they are free could they love. In fact, the Grand Inquisitor, to a certain degree, understood that. He said to Christ, thou did increase freedom and burden the spiritual kingdom of mankind with its sufferings forever. Thou did desire man's free love, that he should follow thee freely, enticed and taken captive by thee. In place of that rigid ancient law, man must thereafter with free heart decide for himself what is good as what is evil, having only thy image before him as his guide. But did thou not know that he would at last reject even thy image and thy truth? If weighed down with the fearful burden of free choice, they will cry aloud at last that the truth is not in thee, for they cannot have been left in greater confusion and suffering than that thou hast created, laying so upon them so many cares and unanswerable promises. Whew. Wow. He said you wanted them to follow you out of love, not some Machiavellian concept of the power of fear. But that doesn't work. No, you have to make them fear you, and then they will follow you. But the Grand Inquisitor didn't get it. God wants beings who would truly love him freely. And this is what the Grand Inquisitor mocked, because even their freedom, he said, because even in their freedom, they're going to reject him. But you know, here's where he misses the point. Sure, God created humans free, and that freedom caused suffering. But to never truly understand the cost of the freedom till you see Jesus on the cross. Because at the cross, that's where we see what freedom cost God. Yet it was so important, so crucial for God to make us free that God knew this would happen to us. He was willing to go to the cross anyway. And that's something I don't think the old man, the Grand Inquisitor, ever understood. Anyway, how does the story end? Let me read you the ending myself. Let me read it to you. When the inquisitor ceased speaking, he waited some time for his prisoner to answer him. His silence weighed down upon him. He saw that the prisoner had listened intently all the time, looking gently in his face and evidently not wishing to reply. The old man longed for him to say something, however bitter and terrible. But he suddenly approached the old man in silence and softly kissed him on his bloodless, aged lips. That was all his answer. The old man shuddered. His lips moved. He went to the door, opened it, and said to him, "Go and come no more. Come not at all. Never, never." And he let him out into the dark alleyways of town. The prisoner went away. And that's how Dostoevsky ended the Grand Inquisitor. After he railed against Christ and railed against Christ and railed against Christ, threatening to kill him on and on. How does it end? Jesus kisses him. And the old man, the Grand Inquisitor, not knowing what to do, not understanding what to do with the power of love, sends him away and tells him, never return. Never, never. Whew. What a powerful ending to this story. What a powerful way of God saying to us, hey, I love you so much. Sure. Freedom has caused suffering and sorrow, but I have suffered worse among this more than any of you because I went to the cross. Love, that's the power of love. Love has a power that even the paragon of power, the Grand Inquisitor, could not himself understand or handle.